Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Jonathan Bennett joins me. We're going to be talking about OWASP Dependency Track, which lets you know your vulnerabilities in the software you're running right now. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Jonathan Bennett. Episode 478, recorded April 4th, 2018. OWASP Dependency Track. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/floss. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, Libre, open source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at SunEdge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, little projects, projects you may be using every day and unaware of it, projects you might want to go check out right after this show. I bet today is going to be one of those. Joining me once again is my lovely and talented co-host, Jonathan Bennett. Welcome back.
Hey, Randall. It is good to be back once again. Third week in a row. Goodness.
Oh, we're going to have to, we got to let you retire for a while there. It just keeps being areas where you seem to have some expertise in. So that's why I like to bring you on when I can, because you seem to have a bent about security, which is what today's show is going to be about. And where are we speaking to you? Same place as last week?
Yes, the home office here in Lawton, Oklahoma. And I don't want to retire, but a vacation from time to time would be nice.
A vacation. we'll give you that vacation. So hopefully one of the other rotating panel co-hosts will step up for next week. I am once again in my bare-walled room, bedroom in the house I live in Portland, Oregon, or Beaverton, actually, just a little west of Portland. I will not be here next week. I'll actually be back at Santa Monica at ZipRecruiter. So I'll have the really intense bandwidth location and probably a pretty good view. I think I have Malibu again, so that's probably going to be that nice outline of the mountains, not mountains, man-made mountains. What do they call those? Buildings. Buildings, yes. There'll be buildings behind me, the mountains. Oh, it's silly today. So let's talk about what today's project is all about. It's going to be, let me put my notes here, it's going to be, scroll, the OWASP Dependency Track. It's a software composition analysis platform that keeps track of all third-party components used in all the applications an organization creates or consumes. And I should mention that OWASP actually stands for the Open Web Application Security Project, which is actually an umbrella organization that has a number of projects under it, of which this is one of them. And we'll be bringing, where's Steve's name? Steve something? Steve Springett on in a minute or so to talk about it. But these kinds of applications, these kinds of things that do the analysis are really more and more important these days because, you know, like even my primary client, ZipRecruiter, uses dozens, if not hundreds, of third-party software. And they bring it together and a lot of it gets exposed directly or indirectly to customer traffic, to the web traffic coming in, email coming in, things like that. And so how do you, with this myriad of stuff going on, how do you read and follow every single CVE that comes out, every single update, Red Hat publishes various updates when security bugs are found. And this is the kind of software that's becoming more and more essential. I think we've done a couple of these so far. I can't remember back a ways. One of them actually looked inside Docker containers for things. That was sort of fun. And we actually have another one coming up soon. It's a similar project. So these are becoming more and more essential. So I'm really glad we have Steve coming on today to talk about this. Jonathan, what do you know about this so far?
I know that someone, it may have been Steve Gibson even, said information wants to be free and code wants to be wrong. And the further along we get into security and computer science and such, the more and more ways programmers have figured out to mess their code up, to make it vulnerable. I think there's a near infinite number of possibilities of how code can be broken and, work correctly most of the time, but still have enough of a problem that it's vulnerable to something or other. And so there's a bunch of tools. Last week we talked about Rust, which is one of those tools that can help. But yeah, there's no single silver bullet. And so what a programmer is or a organization, you know, what we do now is just try to make use of as many of those tools as we can to make it harder and harder. Really, what people are trying to do is to avoid being the low-hanging fruit. They don't want to be you don't want your application to be trivial to break, and just make it as secure as possible. And I think today we're going to be talking about another tool or toolkit that can help with that. I don't know a whole lot about this toolkit in particular, but I'm hoping that I can add it to my bag of tricks of things that can help with the problem security.
Okay, good. Yeah, that sounds really interesting. And you know, with all these breaches I've been hearing about, you know, but I want to bet, although I don't know the inside information on this, I want to bet about 80% of these breaches we're hearing about, where huge companies are getting lots of their data hacked, are not just from bad web practices, because that happens. And I don't want to blame PHP in particular. I don't want to blame SQL injection in particular. But I bet a lot of it is probably they're running Windows somewhere. You know, I like to blame Windows, so that's why I did that way. Okay. Anyway, but we're going to bring Steve on in just a minute. But before we do that, I have a very important message. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. The mortgage experience wasn't keeping up with the times. It was dated, and it needed a client-focused technological revolution. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It's simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. It's convenient. Their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. It's powerful. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in seconds. Based on your income, assets, and credit, Rocket Mortgage can analyze all of the home loan options for which you qualify and find the one that's just right for you. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/floss. That's rocketmortgage.com/FLOSS. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of Floss Weekly. Now let's go ahead and bring on our guest. Steve, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me, Randall. Appreciate it.
And where are you speaking to us from?
I am in my condo in Chicago.
All right. Is it snowy, cold, or just breezy?
It is a little chilly out there today. There's just a little bit of snow out on the ground. I woke up this morning and was not very happy to see that, but such is life.
Yeah. Well, it's better than to see a little bit of snow than to see, you know, 6 feet deep of snow. And I know that's happened there from time to time, too. So you're probably still ahead of the game. So that's great. Give us a 30,000-foot view. What is Dependency Track and what's it used for?
Absolutely. So Dependency Track is really about tracking all of the components that are used in various applications that an organization might create by themselves or use in terms of commercial off-the-shelf software. It's really about tracking all the mostly open source, but it's not just an open source issue. It's about tracking all the components, and because we're tracking them as bill of materials, we can discover if they have any known vulnerabilities in them.
And is this something that would look at, say, my Git repo and analyze it from there, or do I have to do some sort of setup to start using this?
It's part of a larger ecosystem. There's some related projects, one of which is Dependency Check, for example, that this the Dependency Track actually builds on top of. But Dependency Check would actually be something that would be used in a continuous integration style environment, where if you're checking out code from GitHub, you would actually run your analysis at build time, and the result of that analysis can be uploaded automatically to Dependency Track. So we have an ongoing record of all of the components that are used during build time.
And with something like Dependency Check, which apparently is being used with this, is that something that I could even have the continuous integration system like abort and not generate products to install?
Absolutely. So Dependency Check is actually a really great project. I've been contributing to it since about 2012. It was started by a security researcher and engineer by the name of Jeremy Long. And essentially what it does is it looks at files on the file system and tries to extract evidence from those files and match them up with known CVEs in the National Vulnerability Database. And because it looks at files, build time analysis is one of the primary objectives for that. I actually wrote the Jenkins plugin for that ecosystem. So yeah, you can absolutely put builds in a failed or warning state depending on if there's any new issues found.
So dependency track isn't doing that. So what's dependency track's problem it's solving?
Absolutely. So it's part of a larger problem. We as developers, we look at it as a continuous integration type of problem. But it's really this issue is far beyond just build time of software. This is really a supply chain issue. It affects everything from developing software to running that software in production to buying, you know, drones or any kind of Internet of Thing type of appliance. How do we track the components that are used in build time or the applications that we run in our environment or use as a consumer? How do we track those components and discover if there's any known vulnerabilities in them?
And just to get a sense of how frequently there's a new known vulnerability, I mean, I bet there's some of our listeners are probably thinking, well, there's like one new bug report a month or something. But can you give me a sense of like the flow, the speed of which CVEs come out?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of really interesting research as of late. One of the first reports was based in 2012 by a company called Aspec and later Contrast Security. But in that report, I really like to reference that report because it was very specific, even though it's a little bit old as of now. But they looked at Maven Central. And they analyzed the 31 most popular libraries and frameworks at the time. So this is this is Java specific, and they came to the conclusion that 26% of all requests to Maven Central were for things that had known vulnerabilities in them. So these are applications that people are building at that time, and 26% of all the components that they were requesting had known vulnerabilities in them. There's been a lot of other studies since then. And they've basically come to the same types of conclusions where visibility is really the number one issue. And that's why I created the Jenkins plugin for that. And I also created a SonarQube plugin for the dependency check project as well. But visibility is a huge problem in this because in our development environments, they will absolutely tell us if we're using a deprecated method or if we're introducing a performance crippling loop, for example. My IDE is smart enough to tell me that, but without commercial support, my IDE does not tell me that I just chose to use an old vulnerable version of Spring Framework that now has remote code execution capabilities. It doesn't tell me that. So visibility is a huge problem. Going forward. So,
hey, Steve,
to put it in perspective, I just want to throw some numbers out there. In 2016, for example, it kind of varies, but we've generally been averaging between 5,000 and 6,000 CVEs per year. So that's a lot of CVEs. Last year alone, there were over 18,000 CVEs that were reported. And I might add that not all publicly disclosed vulnerabilities are mentioned in the National Vulnerability Database. For example, the VulnDB project, which is a commercial subscription-based service, they have 7,900 vulnerabilities that aren't even listed in the NVD. So that the number of publicly disclosed vulnerabilities just for last year is over 20,000.
Steve, I wanted to jump in if I could, and I think you actually just answered one of the questions I had, but that's okay. We'll get back to it. Dependency track, is it doing any code analysis, you know, specifically to determine what dependencies a piece of code uses? Does it do code analysis?
It is part of the larger ecosystem. So really, it's designed to be integrated with the dependency check ecosystem. So where we're building software components And we're analyzing those things at build time during continuous integration. The reports can be automatically submitted up to dependency track. And then once dependency track actually has the bill of materials, it's going to continue on scanning. So at the end, at its core, dependency track is really about decomposing software, whether we're building software or consuming software, into a series of bill of materials. And using dependency check is one way to do that. But we also support SPDX, which is a Linux Foundation-based project that does two really interesting things. It supports bill of materials, but it also supports the open source license IDs as well. But really, dependency track is about bill of materials, and then once we have those bill of materials, we can then analyze all that evidence on a daily basis to see if there's any new vulnerabilities reported. Couple really interesting use cases for this is when a new vulnerability comes out, you need to really quickly determine what applications in your organization are affected, right? So when a new 10.0, high severity thing that is just announced, as an organization, I want to see what applications are affected in my organization, and I can really quickly do that if I'm using something like dependency track.
So I'm still trying to figure out exactly how all of this chain fits together, and the fact that there's dependency check and dependency track with similar names is, I think, kind of throwing me off. So dependency track, we feed into that. Here are the dependencies that we know this project has, and then dependency track keeps track of what vulnerabilities are in that. Is that how that works?
That's correct. On an ongoing basis.
Okay. Very good. And then. Is this fire and forget, or is this something that has to be run every time? So if I have a server or an instance up in the cloud somewhere that's running software on it, can I feed the software into dependency track and say, hey, I've got this library and this library and this library, I'm running Apache on it, I'm running PHP, here are the versions. I want to get an email when something big and bad is found, I need to go update that. Is that kind of in scope for dependency track?
Absolutely. That's exactly what it's designed for. Alerts are coming. They're not in the product yet. They are coming, I think, in the next release. But that's exactly what the use case is designed for. I've got a principal, a friend of mine who's a principal at one of these software consulting shops. They do one-off software for organizations. And one of the use cases I had envisioned when I developed this was when he developed software, these one-off applications for organizations. They deliver the software, obviously, and move on to the next client. Well, wouldn't it be a really great relationship type thing to be able to say, hey, Mr. Customer, this thing that we developed for you 6 months ago, it now has a vulnerability in it from this third-party library. We'd like to come in and fix it for you. It's going to cost 3 hours of our time. But just imagine the type of relationship that you could have if organizations were proactive like that.
Yeah, that's certainly it helps everybody out. You know, it maintains that relationship, but then it also makes the end product more secure. So you touched on this. Obviously, the CVE database is one source where you can find out about these problems. Does dependency track go out and check any other sources? Does it have support for using other sources of problems?
Absolutely. So dependency track supports the NVD, which is kind of the bar to entry for this type of solution. But it also supports NSP, the Node Security Platform. So folks running Node, for example, we'd be able to get advisories from NSP. We are working on support for VulnDB. To put this in perspective, the NVD has about 104,000 vulnerabilities in its database. VulnDB has about 160,000. And we will continue working with other sources of vulnerability intelligence going forward.
And then a follow-on to that, we hear in the news all the time, you know, some hacker is, or some researcher, excuse me, some researcher has found a problem and does a responsible disclosure to, say, Google or Microsoft or whatever. And so that problem is known about for maybe 6 months before it gets fixed. And so you end up having these, they're essentially like CVEs, but only a small group of people know about it. Is there any way that Dependency Track handles that kind of a scenario where maybe a customer knows that there's a problem? Is there some way to feed that into Dependency Track?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting and unfortunately common use case. Essentially, what you end up in the NVD is you end up with CVEs that are in a reserve status, where the CVE has been assigned, but no information has been added to it. Commercial services like VulnDB, for example, fill in the gaps. That's a subscription-based service. Dependency Track is in the process of trying to integrate with that. But there are commercial vendors in this space as well that offer some really great solutions to this type of problem. One of the things that some of the commercial vendors do is, instead of using just sources of vulnerability intelligence like the NVD or VulnDB, they will actually reach out to and look at commit logs. They will look at change logs. They will look at Twitter accounts for project leaders, because sometimes that is the only source of publicly disclosed information. So the more ad hoc approach that you can get to discovering these vulnerabilities, the more heuristic type of analysis that we can perform to identify these vulnerable components.
And then, is there a way for Dependency Track to integrate with something like a package manager? So, you know, if we're running CentOS, have Yum spit out, these are all the packages that are installed. Is there an easy way for that to work together with Dependency Track so it knows a whole lot of information about the state of the system?
As you know, there are a lot of package managers out there. I mean, just in Linux alone, there's you know, more than a handful. Dependency Track is actually has an API first design. The API is fully documented using Swagger. So doing that type of work would be really elementary. Just basically reading out the contents of whatever package manager you want to integrate with and using the REST API for Dependency Track should be really simple.
Well, I can't let Jonathan have the entire show, so I want to ask a few questions as well. We actually have a couple questions from the chat room here. Excuse me. Does it support like Java and .NET? That's Reverb Mike asked that.
Absolutely. So Dependency Track itself is language framework agnostic. It doesn't care. In fact, the NVD, a lot of people don't know this, but the NVD doesn't do just software. In fact, there are three different what they call parts to the NVD. One part is applications, and that includes things like libraries and frameworks. Another part is operating systems. And the third part is devices or hardware. As we know, the Intel processors, AMD processors, they had vulnerabilities recently as well. Dependency Track can absolutely track those types of components as well. So it's language framework agnostic. And in terms of our sister project, Dependency Check, which integrates with various build environments and continuous integration, it absolutely supports Java.
So I could tell Dependency Track that I have a certain brand of router and a certain brand of, say, firewall system or whatever. And this would be something that Dependency Track would look for updates on, look for vulnerabilities on?
That's the goal, right. So right now, as of today, we can absolutely include those things in our bill of materials. The next release, we will be adding full hardware analysis to the platform as well.
Cool. Emily Lestrange, a frequent guest in our chat room, asked a real good question. Is there what's your interaction with this? Is there a GUI for it? Is it all command line? Or is it just plugins for other applications? How do you get to this?
Absolutely. So Dependency Track itself is a web-based application. It's distributed as a Docker container. It's written in Java, and we supply a conventional WAR as well as a self-executing WAR.
Who chose Java?
Well, that's what I typically program in, although it is verbose. And about halfway into the project, you know, I'm looking at Kotlin. I'm like, wow, I could really cut down about a half of my code if I just switched to Kotlin.
And what are you using on the browser side? Are you using jQuery or something like that?
I am. You know, I am not a big fan of supporting Java frameworks of the week. This is an open source project, and I could have probably saved myself some time by using something like Angular or React. Right. But these things change so frequently, and that is not the focus of this project. So I actually chose to use jQuery, even though it was a little bit more work, but because I know the API has been stable for the last 15 years.
It's quite mature, absolutely. I've used it in a couple of my clients' projects so far, and I really like it, although now I'm moving over towards Dart, so I'm using Angular Dart and on browser side. So much more fun. So you said you did this. Is this something that's sort of been like a sole project just for you, or have you had a lot of contributors to it by now?
We've had some. Dependency Track actually started out in 2013, and it had a really simple use case at the time. In fact, it was too simple, and it really didn't address the problems I was trying to solve. So about 2016 or so, December 2016, I made a painful decision to kind of scrap the old versions of Dependency Track and literally perform kind of a project reboot. What are the problems we're trying to solve, and completely re-architect it and rewrite it from scratch. So it's been a long road, and Dependency Track version 3 was just launched, I think, about a week ago.
Wow, and so is this just a rewrite, or have you added new features to make it worthy of 3?
Oh, it's a complete rethinking of the problem. First of all, everything is API first. It's really designed to be an integral part of the continuous integration, continuous delivery environment, where we are throwing bill of materials at Dependency Track on a pretty consistent basis. And Dependency Track is part of a larger cyber supply chain risk management framework that monitors all those components on a regular basis. So it's absolutely designed to keep pace with how software is being developed today.
Awesome. So you mentioned the number of CVEs just last year was something like 20,000 or something in that ballpark. I want to dispel a myth here, which is that I'm running Linux, therefore I am safe. how many things of that CVEs would you say are probably Linux related?
I have no idea, but there's going to be a lot of them. You know, the same approach used to be said toward Mac users, right? The adversaries are going to attack what people are using. And, you know, a lot of technology folks, we use non-Windows platforms. We use Macs. We use Linux. Most of our servers are all Linux-based. So if I want to attack web services, especially those running in Docker, I have a pretty good chance that those Docker images are going to be running Linux. So there's going to be a lot of Linux-based vulnerabilities. And that doesn't necessarily mean that it's Linux kernel-based vulnerabilities. It could be a supported vulnerabilities in like Bash or Tar or something that is just included with most Linux distributions.
Hey, I want to jump in if I can. Is there support, and this may be a bad idea, but is there support for automatically doing updates when problems are found?
You know, that is a really that actually leads into a different kind of conversation. But it's interesting to me that we treat software as a more of an assembly line type of approach. We have this analogy that software is eating the world, right? There's just so much software out there, but we apply this biological metaphor to it, yet we treat it like the thing that I created in March is going to be identical to the thing I created in December, and that's not true. As much as I like to pick on the Node ecosystem, just because JavaScript. They're doing a lot of things right. They have an approach where they specify minimum versions of components. So repeatable builds aren't necessarily a priority for them. They specify minimum versions of things, and whenever something is built, they use the latest version. I think that's a great thing. One of the issues with Java is in more mature ecosystems is the fact that we specify specific versions for things in the hopes of repeating builds, but repeatable builds introduce a lot of risk to the supply chain. I'm a big proponent of forcing the latest versions of component usage, including those transitive dependencies as well, all the time. In fact, I'd like to get to a point where runtime environments, whether it's V8 or the JVM, I would like to get to the point where runtime environments are automatically updating themselves. If we're applying biological metaphors to software, and we think software is eating the world, I think software needs to be smart enough to be able to update its own dependencies. It's 2018, and we have the ability to specify REST APIs. We can specify a YAML or JSON file to specify API contracts between the clients and servers and have those endpoints and those clients automatically created and with the ability to talk to themselves. Yet we don't have something similar to our APIs that we use as software components, and that's a real shame. I really hope somebody that's smarter than me is working on that problem, because I think playing whack-a-mole, the strategy of what we're doing today, where we identify a component, we try to mitigate it. In your example, you said 6 months, and I think that's just a horrific but realistic time frame. I think that's we need to respond faster than that. The real shame is that when a lot of these vulnerabilities are publicly disclosed, depending on the library being targeted, a lot of times we're within hours of being of that exploit being weaponized, and if we are dealing with weaponized exploits within a matter of hours, sometimes sooner, 6 months to fix something is pretty much a non-starter. So we as an industry, I think, have got to do a better job, and whack-a-mole is, I don't believe, a strategy that we can maintain too much going forward.
Emily the Strange in the chat room says, "No, I hate auto updates. At least with Windows, I get the 'you must reboot your PC for updates right now.'" Which I thought was a funny commentary.
Absolutely.
Speaking of whack-a-mole, we could say, to use that metaphor, that dependency track is playing whack-a-mole very quickly and automatically for us. Is that fair?
It is. That would be a good analogy. Yeah. I saw a tweet, I think it was last week, and I don't know if there's any validity to this. Maybe somebody in the chat room can look it up. But I saw a tweet the other day, last week, that basically said the lifetime for Node.js libraries was, I think, 11 days or something like that. And it was a kind of a futurist tweet where we're going to come to the point in the future where it's going to be the age of components are going to be updated in minutes, and eventually come to the point where when you start a build and you have the most updated components, by the time that build finishes, their components are already already out of date. Now, it's kind of surreal to think about that, and I don't see it happening anytime soon. But, in 10 years, I can absolutely see that being a problem. And I think we need to think about that in the, and start developing solutions for that in the future.
Yeah, to kind of think about a little bit more the points you were making, not all software, but not all bugs are created equal. You know, I mean, you find in a C program, you have a pointer problem. Well, someone that understands the problem may be able to fix that in all of 5 minutes. But then on the other extreme, you've got a problem like the one Intel and AMD were just notified about. Well, it's going to take a year and a half before they finally get to the point to where they're taping out processors after they were notified of the problem. Those processors get fabbed and then get out to the end user. There's just this huge difference in time scale between some of these different security problems. What does that look like going forwards? What does the industry do about that?
That's a great thing, because in the software world, we're so used to agile methodologies, we can hopefully quickly fix things, in a more expedited type of way. The issue that was reported with a well-known bakery here in the United States, exposing millions of customer information here just a couple days ago. They knew about the problem for, I think it was 8 months, but it took them 2 hours to fix the problem. As organizations, we really need to have a culture of security. Security is not the job of the security team. Security is really everybody's job, from the CEO to the project managers to the developers to the QA. Security is just an attribute that everybody needs to take part in, because it really does affect all of us.
So we talked a little bit about you're hoping to do support for devices, like checking for firmware in a router. Is there any plan to be able to maybe do automatic network discovery and say, oh, here's this device, and then yank off of that, here's the firmware version it's running? Is that something that's in scope for this project?
It's not. No, there's as Randall was mentioning in the opening, there's a lot of different types of components. We can look at components from a Docker perspective. We can look at components from a network or infrastructure perspective. There's a lot of different types of tools that are necessary to be able to identify vulnerabilities in various types of components. And unfortunately, there is no silver bullet. It doesn't exist. There is no perfect solution for this type of problem. The only solution that exists today is to use multiple types of tools that focus on various different parts of coming, being able to identify these vulnerable components from different angles. So you might look at Docker containers. You might look at networking issues. You might look at CloudFormation or whatnot, vulnerabilities in that. You might look at from my perspective, you might look at software components like Java or Node or Ruby, and be able to do that. But the problem is really a supply chain issue, and there's a lot of different types of tools that are necessary in the entire supply chain to be able to discover and notify organizations of this type of issue. And dependency track is one of those things that fit into this category.
So just thinking through that scenario a step further, what we could imagine then is you have another tool that is a network scanner that goes out and tries to determine as much as it can what firmware version something is running. And then that tool would feed that information into dependency track. And together you could get that sort of a scenario dealt with, where you can track firmwares for your various devices.
Absolutely. Again, having that API first design was really key in the foundation of which dependency track would be built on. You know, I can only imagine so many different types of use cases and create UI metaphors for that, for a web browser. But because the APIs are publicly exposed and well documented, if you can imagine the use case, you can probably do it. So that type of scenario would be absolutely possible.
And then we've talked about, obviously, Linux servers, Docker. Is there support for Windows? I know. Don't throw tomatoes at me, guys. Windows Server or even Windows desktops, is that something that Dependency Track could take a look at and track?
As of now, no. We have, unfortunately, an artificial limitation on being tracking operating systems and hardware devices. That is going to be changing in the next release. I'm targeting that toward the end of Q2 this year. So that artificial limitation will be lifted, and we'll be able to fully analyze operating systems as well as devices. So any operating system, any hardware, as long as it's there's records of it in a vulnerability intelligence source like the NBD, we'll be able to discover it.
So I like to think that all software once created continues to be maintained forever, but that, we know that's not the case. So what happens? What happens when we see a CVE or something in the NSD about an application that's no longer being maintained by its owner? Is there notation for that? This is just not a patch coming for this in the databases that you can flag specially in Dependency Track?
No, in Dependency Track there's not. There's a lot of different ecosystems. Obviously, Node, Java, PHP. There's a lot of different sources for tracking the components and what the latest versions are and that sort of thing. Some of the commercial vendors, for example, really focus on this type of thing. In fact, they will integrate with the various sources of those components and be able to tell you. Things are outdated, for example. They'll even be able to supply, in a lot of cases, they'll even be able to determine whether or not an open source project is at risk itself. As an OWASP project, I'm always coming to the game with security, because security is all important. But there's different types of risk as well. Developers have an immense amount of power when it comes to choosing open source components, and sometimes choosing a component that is no longer maintained, maybe the project doesn't respond to issues or pull requests, that sort of thing, that's actually a risk. My project isn't necessarily concerned about the non-security risk, but some of the commercial products in this space absolutely do put an emphasis on that, which I think is a great thing.
It's like Perl, for example, goes through a full new release every year, and their policy is actually that it's basically anything that's more than about 3 years old is EOL'd, which is really funny because you take a Red Hat distro and it has a Perl that's 6 years old, and then it's like, well, we're not getting security patches on this one anymore. So, and I know there's a lot of projects like that are just a little crazy because, you want to have security updates, you want to have maintenance on things, and so that's an important point. But your Dependency Track isn't about that, you said?
It's not necessarily about keeping things up to date. In fact, I don't think, although the commercial vendors do it, I prefer the approach that developers always use the latest and greatest of everything and force transitive dependency updates. And then if builds break, then force that back on the open source community to have them update their transitive dependencies. I'm of the fan that we should always be using the latest and greatest of everything, not simply because it's a best practice, but what happens in a scenario where we are specifying a specific version of a component, right? And the component is free of vulnerabilities. It's free of vulnerabilities. It's all good for a number of years. And major releases of that component have occurred. What happens when the eventual time comes when a critical vulnerability is reported against that component? If the APIs have changed dramatically, I can no longer fix that really quickly. You know, right. What might have been a fix that could take me 10 minutes now might take me 10 days, and I have to shut down the service in order to protect my organization as a result. So if we're constantly using the latest versions of libraries, we are more able to respond with expedience when the time comes.
So I'm presuming this is not your day job, is that right?
This is not my day job, no. I actually do security architecture and leadership for an organization. But I've been in security for quite a while. I actually started out as a kid, kind of mischievous kid, and got into security that way. Did some physical security stuff for alarm systems and banks and for high rises here in Chicago in my early 20s, and then realized you can get paid a decent wage by being a programmer, which is something I love. So I spent like 20 years in software engineering, and then in about between 2008 and 2012, I started getting into security really full time, and been doing that ever since, and love it because it's ever changing, which is really fun.
Do you know how to pick a lock?
I do. And certain types of locks. Certain types of locks are a little easier than others, but lockpick villages are absolutely a thing at the various cons. So yes.
It always comes up. The only kind of lock I know how to pick is the remember the old bicycle chains that had the six or the four wheels that have the six digits on each one? Somebody showed me that if you pull it in and out a little bit, you can see which ones are not lined up yet. And so as soon as all four of them don't line up, you pull it straight out. And I'll tell you, one time as a prank, I went to the bike rack at my grade school. So this is how long it was. And I took all the chains and I put them on other people's bikes.
Hilarious.
So I've had my mischievous side as well. I shouldn't admit that on a public show, but no, actually, I think I've said it before at conferences and stuff. So anyway, that was fun though. I just stood back in the corner and just kind of walk and watch people. Hey, my bike's locked up, but this is not my lock. Oh, that was bad. That was totally bad. So this is like a nights and weekends thing for you then? It's just a labor of love?
Absolutely. Yeah, security is definitely a passion of mine, and this is such a huge problem. And like I said earlier, you know, there isn't a silver bullet. No solution to this problem is perfect, and multiple solutions are really required. But really, the goal of this project was to be an open source solution to a mostly open source problem. I'm not going to say it's a completely open source problem. It's not. But the things you hear about in the news all the time. A lot of times they involve vulnerabilities and open source components. So it's really about trying to give back to the community, and in the spirit of continuous improvement, I really hope that that others see value in this and start contributing to it. But at the end of the day, my project, as well as the dependency check project, we really don't care what organizations use in terms of being able to identify and fix these types of issues. If the only benefit we're bringing to the table is just more awareness of the problem, then that's okay. That's okay. We just want organizations to use something.
And what is Dependency Track still missing? What's on the roadmap? And what kind of people do you need to help you with it?
Well, we need a lot of different things, but we use GitHub milestones for everything. So I've got the I'm planning on quarterly releases. We did our first release at the end of Q1. I've got another release going out at the end of Q2. That's really going to focus on auditing, being able to look at the findings and determine whether or not something was a false positive or not, or if something may not necessarily be affected by the project that it's used in. Auditing is a big key, as well as full integration with VulnDB. That's also on my immediate roadmap. But I've got milestones for the next three or four releases already planned out. One of the things that the project really could use a lot of is unit and integration tests. I know it's not necessarily fun work, but it's really, really important work to do.
I want to jump in real quick if I can and just ask, don't you think that everybody doing computer security should, at least to some extent, have some physical security experience just gives such a better perspective on security and all the different ways they could go wrong.
You know, there's a lot of different types of jobs in the security industry. I mean, if you're looking at vulnerabilities, absolutely having that physical aspect, I think is interesting. It adds a little bit more perspective. But there's other folks who come to security, you know, from a risk management type of perspective, non-technical background, and that's okay too. Those types of jobs are very valuable. But physical security, that was a lot of fun.
Yes, you touched on this idea of this particular problem being primarily an open source problem, and I always think about that a little bit differently. We get to see the problem in open source because by the nature of it, we get to see the sausage being made. Don't you think that the exact same problem happens in proprietary software? We just don't get all the insight into it because their mailing list isn't out in the clear. And the open source, the source code is not in the clear.
Absolutely, I think the number of open source components that are readily out there. I think I would like to see some studies on that. Maybe somebody in the chat room can do that quick little search. But I think the number of open source projects in existence is absolutely staggering, and as a adversary, if I'm targeting an organization. I am going to go after the vulnerabilities in open source first, because by nature, I might not necessarily know the insides of the proprietary components. But you are absolutely right. Just because we don't necessarily have visibility of whether or not these private, you know, consumed components may or may not have vulnerabilities in them, doesn't necessarily mean it's not true.
Sure. And then one last question I wanted to ask is what license is OpenTrack under? How restrictive is it for use?
It's Apache 2.0. You know, use it however you want that conforms with Apache 2.0 license.
All right. Excellent.
Cool. Sorry, gentlemen. we're almost out of time. I have two questions that I have to ask. Well, three questions, actually, I have to ask. One is there anything we didn't talk about today that you wanted to make sure our audience is aware of before we have to let you go?
No, not really. Just keeping your components updated. It's a huge issue. And if that's the only message, if that's the only takeaway, then my job is done.
Awesome. And what's your primary scripting language?
You know, I have a love for Perl. I was an early web developer. I got into professional programming in the early 90s, so 93, 94, right? And you know, Perl was it. I was using Perl for some amazing stuff back in the day, and I definitely have a certain love for it.
For those of you who aren't watching the video and just listening to this on the audio, I'm grinning ear to ear right now. So that was great. Finally, somebody said Perl again. Well, okay, let's see if it's one out of two or two out of two. What's your favorite text editor?
Text editor. When I'm in a GUI, I will either use Visual Studio Code or TextMate on a Mac. And when I am in command line mode, I will typically reach for Vim first.
Okay. So Vim, that's close enough though. But I like that you mentioned Visual Studio Code. I'm getting into that because of my Dart and Flutter interactions. It's the first time I've gotten away from Emacs and into something that's not Emacs. So it's really sort of amazing to finally make the switch to something that has IntelliSense and a whole bunch of other cool things for doing Flutter. So that's really really convenient for that. But thank you for saying Perl. Thank you for saying Perl. It's it's rare on this show. Apparently, all the cool kids are in Python and Ruby and other things. So it's kind of nice that way. Steve, it's been great having you on the show and talking about Dependency Track and exposing this to a bunch of new people, and hopefully some more people come on board to help you add all your wish list items, help you solve those out. And if nothing else, maybe people start using this to be able to do what you said it does, which is, you know, being able to track potential vulnerabilities in the code that I'm using today on my project. So really appreciate that, Steve.
Appreciate your time today. Thanks, guys.
All right, guys. That was Steve Springett talking to us about Dependency Track. What do you think there, Jonathan?
So when I first heard about Dependency Track, I immediately thought, oh no, it's another one of those buzzword-filled projects that doesn't actually do anything. And boy, I was wrong. This is really, really powerful, potentially. In fact, I'm getting all sorts of good and interesting ideas for ways this could be used in different places. Really, really interesting what he's doing. And it's such a simple idea. It's such a simple idea that, hey, let's track all the different things. We have a database with all of our versions, and then we go and see, are there CVEs against those versions? I mean, that is the essence of what he's doing. Such a simple idea. But you then start combining it with all of these other tools that can do things like automatically keep up with what version you're running, or automatically do a build and know what versions go into the build. And suddenly it's a very, very powerful set of tools. Really interesting.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. This is, we're going to talk about this forever. We're almost out of time here. So, again, very important to be running at least something like this. Yes, there are many players in this space. In fact, we have one coming up in about 6 weeks, which we'll talk about in a second. So very, very cool stuff, in this area. And it's so, you know, I'd like to say that programmers shouldn't be allowed to touch the keyboard till they really understand why a null pointer is bad. But the truth is, we have a lot of junior programmers out there. We have a lot of people who don't have their code audited by more senior people. Won't mention any current clients I have. Okay. But, you know, some people's code's getting pushed out to production without a lot of review. And that's causing issues everywhere. I mean, that's these constant stories of data breaches are more and more troubling to me, you know, because I think back to, I think the most recent breach was only name, email address, and last four digits of the credit card you had on file. But that's still a lot of information for a lot of people, millions, I think it was, something in the millions, and just an insane amount of data out there that has been released by breaches, and it's really sad. So people should be using more of these things. Anything else before I read up the up list?
No, not particularly. It's just I had a conversation with someone just the other day about this, and it's like, well, here's the things to keep in mind. One, your information is out there, and two, don't put anything on the internet you don't want everybody to be able to see. It's almost like the old email is as secure as a postcard. Well, we're getting to the point to where all of the internet is barely more secure than a postcard in practice.
Yes, and don't use the same password in every one of your accounts, idiots. I use password managers all the time. I use generated passwords and all the recent stuff I've done. But even before that, every password that I typed in was unique. And it's still true to this day. So very important, very important. Yes. Anyway, enough of that. Let's go ahead and talk about who's coming up next. Because next week, we're going to bring on the Pigeon Live Purple Game Multiple Chat Protocol Library. It's a Pigeon, formerly named Game, is a free and open source multi-platform instant messaging client based on a library named Live Purple that has been in support for many instant messaging protocols. Although AIM is no longer supported because AIM is gone. Bye-bye, AIM. Sorry about that. It's probably why they renamed their application. Following that, the Univention Corporate Server is server and IT management software to regain flexibility and control. That's a nice mission statement, but I don't have any idea what that means. Chompers after that. It's an internet blocking program that he developed for Linux. You define a whitelist or a blacklist of websites, and Chomper will block you from visiting the non-whitelisted or blacklisted websites for the amount of time you specify. This is clearly something I absolutely need and will never use. So anyway, I like to be distracted. I am self-diagnosed ADHD, and I just want to see other sites right now. Just added to the schedule between last week and this week, PyPy. So people are always looking for more Python shows here. This is the Python Package Index, the repository of software for the Python programming language, equivalent to, from what I can tell, it's equivalent to the CPAN for Perl and gems for Ruby, things like that. So, yeah. Anyway, it says on their webpage today, this morning when I looked, they have 134,346 packages. That's actually, I think, a little bit bigger than CPAN, not much bigger though. Also just added to the schedule, got contacted by the guys running Seagull, S-E-A-G-L. Seagull is a grassroots technology conference dedicated to spreading awareness and knowledge about the GNU Linux community and free Libre open source software and hardware. It's happening up in Seattle, Washington on November 9th and 10th of this year. And we're going to have somebody representing the Seagull projects, the Seagull conference. I put it on my calendar, so I'm almost certainly going to be there just because it's cool. Also, it's free. It's absolutely free. You don't have to pay anything to go to it, which is even better. You just have to pay to get to Seattle if you're not from there. And finally, one more, the Lounge. Which is a self-hosted IRC client. So that's going to be interesting. IRC is still around. We're still using it even for this show as our chat room. And finally, rounding up the schedule currently scheduled is Hubble Stack. Hubble is a modular open source security compliance framework. Ah, why does that sound familiar? I think we just had a whole show about this. The project provides an on-demand profile-based auditing, real-time security event notifications, automated remediation, alerting, and reporting. That sounds like a soup-to-nuts solution for something that's similar to what we just talked about today. If you want to see all these, the upcoming schedule and see who we're working on, go to twit.tv/floss. It's the homepage for this show. There's a link from there to what I like to call the big spreadsheet, which has all that information. If you have other suggestions, please tell the project leader or community coordinator to email me, merlin@stonehenge.com. My address is on that page. Don't write it down. Just go to that page. Remember, twit.tv/floss. That's the important thing. We have a live stream at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays at live.twit.tv. We took a number of questions, actually greater than zero this time, took a number of questions from the chat room today, so that was really fun. Sometimes it's just zero, but that's still a number. That's a number of questions. You follow us on Floss Weekly on Google+, and at Floss Weekly on Twitter. You can follow me at Randall L. Schwartz on Google+, and at Merlin on Twitter, M-E-R-L-Y-N, of course. What am I plugging? Let's see. So my plugs are that I will be at the Red Hat Summit in San Francisco in May. I was invited once again to be there representing Floss Weekly and looking for new guests. I think about every time I've gone to Red Hot Summit, that's the other conference, Red Hat Summit, Red Hat Summit. Oh, they let anybody do this show. Last two times I've gone there, I've gotten at least 5 or 6 guests each time. So it's been always been very productive for me to hang out there for a few days. And I also have great parties, so that's kind of fun too. And I'll also be at the Pro Conference in Salt Lake City in June, again, representing press there, looking for new guests for Floss Weekly, and also probably do another lightning talk, this time not on Dart. I'll do it on Flutter because I'm much more excited about Flutter these days. Oh, and if you haven't seen that yet, I was at Scale a couple weeks ago, and I did an hour-long talk on Flutter, and it was well-received. We had 70 people hang out with us, 70 people in the room during the talk, and then about 40 of them stayed during the half-hour break before the next gig in that room, asking questions, and then they kicked us out, and so about 20 of us went out in the hallway. We had another hour discussion out in the hallway, so people were really excited about building iOS and Android applications in a whole new way. This is game-changing, absolutely game-changing. All right, so that's all I have to plug. Anything you want to plug there, Jonathan?
I will mention you can follow me at JP_Bennett on Twitter, and that's about it for me today.
Well, that was simple. Well, Jonathan, I'm pretty sure you're going to be able to take next week off, so we at least get a 1 week vacation in there for you. It's you've
good.
Done more than your share of the recent talks, but I always appreciate it when you can come on and add your expertise, especially in the area of security. So that's always very fun. So,
yes,
having said that, we'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.